Hello, and welcome back to an all-new episode of The Financial Confessions. It's me, your host, Chelsea Fagan, founder and CEO of The Financial Diet, and person who loves talking about money. And joining me here in studio today is actually someone that you've seen on the podcast before, and who, if you follow sort of the personal finance ecosystem, you may already be familiar with. She's also a fellow New Yorker, she is an IRL friend of mine, and she is probably, I think, literally the first person in the city that I went out and had a full like Spanish language hangout with, which I'm irrationally proud of. And we have to do it again and it'll be much better this time.
So good.
You know, we didn't have to switch to English at all, basically, which was like, that was my point of pride. But suffice to say, she's someone who's a big friend of TFD and someone who I'm really glad to have back in studio today because she's doing something very, very exciting, which will inform our conversation and which I will let her tell you about herself. But for those of you who may not be familiar, who I'm talking about, and especially if you're listening and can't see, is our friend Cindy Zuniga Sanchez.
Thank you, Chelsea.
Hi.
And thanks to Newly for supporting The Financial Confessions. Go to newly.com and enter code TFD20 for $20 off your first month of clothing rental. NUULY.com and use code TFD20. And thanks to Nutrafol for supporting The Financial Confessions. Nutrafol is the number one dermatologist-recommended hair growth supplement clinically shown to improve your hair growth, thickness, and visible scalp coverage. You can grow thicker, healthier hair and support our show by going to Nutrafol.com and entering the promo code TFC to save $15 off your first month subscription.
So what brings you here today?
Oh, you know, just I think it's really a moment where I can share with the world what I've been working on for the past year.
Which
I'm so excited about. I have written a book.
Yay!
And, you know, it's such a point of pride for me because I have quite literally spent the entire past year pouring my heart, soul, and energy into a personal finance book that does a few things. You know, it tells my story, which I'm very grateful to have been able to share here before on the podcast, and which I'm sure we'll touch on today, but also, you know, serve as a very practical tool for people that are just looking to get their finances in order, or as a resource for those that are already on the journey and are like, okay, what about debt really quick? Or what about credit? Like, should I know just really quickly? And being able to, you know, go to this resource that they can learn from.
Yeah. So what is it called?
So my book is called Overcoming Debt, Achieving Financial Freedom, 8 Pillars to Build Wealth.
Yeah. So for those who may not be familiar, can you talk a little bit about your personal story with debt, which kind of brought you to talking about personal finance and also writing this book?
Yes. So I graduated law school in 2015 with over $200,000 of debt.
Yeah. That's a lot of money.
I know. It's a lot. And, you know, I found myself in this place, a really weird place where, you know, as the daughter of immigrants from a, you know, very low income community in the Bronx, I didn't know anything about money while simultaneously I was going to start a career earning more money than like my family had ever really seen. And I found myself in this awkward position of, you know, there's all this money that's about to come to you in form of a, you know, pretty high paying salary, you know, as a corporate lawyer in New York City. But hold on, you also have all of this debt. Good luck. Right. Good luck on trying to manage not only your debt, but also your new salary and everything that kind of comes with that. And so I think that, you know, for me, I found myself in this position where I really didn't know what to do, to be quite honest. I had no idea. So I went to the internet and I Googled, how do I get out of debt?
Right.
Because that's all I knew to do in terms of information that I had access to. And from there, it kind of opened up this world of personal finance where, you know, educators like you and me, just normal people, were giving financial advice based on really their own journeys. But what I found, unfortunately, was a severe lack of representation. You know, it was quite honestly full of white men. Telling people of, you know, telling younger people how to manage their money as if the way that they managed their money when they were younger, you know, would sufficiently get them out of whatever financial hole they were in. And so to kind of, make a very long story pretty short, you know, I used resources that I found to help really guide my journey. And I started this journey of paying off over $200,000 of debt. It was definitely a journey involved with lots of sacrifice in terms of, no, I did not get to live my best, fabulous New York City lawyer lifestyle, right? But what I did do was create an intentional plan, right? I kind of continued to live as a law student. I kept that lifestyle up. I kept my expenses really low. Even though I lived here in New York City, I kept my housing costs low, transportation, food, all of that. I directed any additional payment that I could to my debt, you know, bonuses, tax refunds, pay raises, everything. I was just directing it towards my debt. And, a few years later, in December 2019, I made my last payment and I became 100% debt free, which is still one of the biggest accomplishments that I have, you know, I've been able to experience in the past few years. I think also because knowing that I did it, one, on my own, you know, it's not like my parents weren't helping me financially or anything like that, but also the greater purpose why I did that, which was really so that I could be in a better position to help my family out financially, which I've been able to do definitely more so in the past few years.
You know, it's interesting because I think, you know, for a lot of people, the sort of one of the most overwhelming things about debt payoff, and this obviously goes doubly so if you don't have a high level of income to help speed up that process, which, you know, is a privilege that should be acknowledged. Like, of course, you know, there are a lot of people with that much debt who are not lawyers.
Yeah.
But even for people who are maybe able to put a lot of money toward it, I think, you know, what you described about choosing to keep your housing costs very low, mm-hmm. to live really far below your means, to not do a lot of the things that you would otherwise be able to do in order to prioritize debt payoff, I think a lot of people have a really, really difficult time accepting that reality,
yeah.
and knowing where to find the balance between total deprivation, which I think yeah. also is like a lot of what some of those, you know, aforementioned old white male personal finance gurus
yeah.
often encourage, which is just this right. really, really, really restrictive lifestyle that you're basically punishing yourself until you're out of debt. But on the other hand, if you are continuing to live as though you didn't have debt, you'll basically always be in debt because
right.
you're just going to be paying, you know, the interest essentially. Mm-hmm. And so my question is, like, how did you find, because even during that time, you were definitely still someone who did enjoy some luxuries.
Yeah.
How did you kind of find the balance between living low and far enough below your means that you were able to pay off debt so quickly while still staying motivated and enjoying yourself?
Yeah, I think so. You know, first of all, I definitely want to acknowledge that I was in a very privileged position. Like, first and foremost, it is very important to acknowledge that. And I always try to acknowledge it in any conversation I have, especially because I am from a low income community.
Right.
I know what living paycheck to paycheck actually looks like for a family. I experienced it most of my life. You know, my family's household income for basically my entire childhood was at or slightly above the federal poverty line for a household of five, you know? So I know what that looks like. And then you have to, you know, you contrast that with what I was experiencing right out of law school, you know, with my corporate law salary. But even so, I think, first of all, that helped with the balance, right? It's just being super mindful of, you know, I know what that reality looks like. And so, you know, people, especially my circle, saying kind of like, oh, I'm broke. It's like, no, you're not broke. Like,
yeah.
you're not broke. You know, I know what broke looks like and sounds like and feels like. And this is not quite that. So I think one is just being very grounded, right, in the privileges that I was being afforded was super important for me. But then the other thing was, in terms of like, how did I actually balance, you know, bringing my lifestyle low enough where I could make significant improvement, progress really on my debt, was focusing on the things that I actually cared about. You know, I didn't care to live in a really expensive, you know, high-rise apartment in New York City. So I was going to stay in my studio apartment in Harlem, where my rent was $1,150 at the time.
Nice.
You know? And so I also don't really care to drive personally, right? Even though I do have a license, right? I know that alone is a surprise for, you know, New York City kids, is like, to have a license is like, bravo, you know? I do. And I used to drive, you know, during college. I went to college out in the suburbs, so I did have a car, but I don't like driving. And so I did not buy a car, you know, sure. And it sounds so simple, right? But that alone saved me on the car payment, insurance, repairs, a garage, gas, you know, that alone saved me on a lot there. And another thing is I value more the experience when it comes to a meal. So enjoying, let's say, brunch with friends or a nice dinner with, you know, my husband, who back then was my boyfriend, you know, rather than food for convenience. Right. So what I mean by that is, you know, I wasn't going out to grab a $15 salad, you know, for a $20 lunch on a daily basis. I was just bringing my lunch from home. And all those things in the aggregate, that does add up. And so I knew that things like that, it's not that I didn't like care about them. Of course, you want to care about safe housing and food and transportation, all that. That's all important. But I didn't care about the extraness of it all. What I did care about, though, and I still was intentional about spending on, was things like travel. You know, and so I would just make sure that I was saving every month in a fund, you know, my travel sinking fund is what I still call it to this day, so that I could have that money to go, you know, wherever it may be when the opportunity came up. So it was really balancing, like, what do I actually want to spend money on, you know, versus totally. Like, what would just be, you know, something nice to have, you know, so that's kind of how I looked at it.
Yeah, I was doing a video the other day where we were just kind of talking about the like phenomenon of like, I feel like the, because there is some data that backs this up, but the whole like spend on experiences, not things.
Yeah.
Like, it's true that like if you're spending on certain things that are, you know, really meaningful, expansive, you know, relational experiences that allow you to, you know, be around people you care about or to yeah. try new things, like you said, but like, that's kind of been taken to mean like any spending that you're doing that's like on yeah. any old bar or restaurant or like just, you know, yeah. activities that you'll forget in a week, that has also been categorized as experiences. And like, unfortunately for me, I think a lot of those experiences are as kind of disposable mm-hmm. as just buying a new thing, yeah. you know?
Yeah.
And I really worry that for a lot of people, like I do think even for people who don't have debt, necessarily and could afford to be spending a lot more while still, you know, saving and all of that, they almost should really try to live on a much more restricted yeah. lifestyle for a month or so, because I do think there are so many purchases that people make, especially if you live in a big city and you have a lot of opportunities to spend around you, that you don't even realize you're making them, or you yeah. don't remember them. Like you talked about, like the $15 salad. Like yeah. I come to the office twice a week, and like usually one of those 2 days I'll get a lunch I don't remember, yeah. you
yeah.
know?
Yeah, well, that's the thing. I think that we need to be careful, right? Because when we just start justifying expenses because, oh, it was an experience, you know, if we're going to do that with all of our expenses, we're going to be broke, right? Like we're not going to save, we're not going to invest, we're not going to progress, you know, on our financial goals. So I really think that what it actually comes down to is really practicing value-based spending.
Hmm.
So what do I actually care about? What do I value? I'm going to go ahead and spend on that. I'll give a perfect example. And a lot of people disagree with me on this. You might disagree with me on this, and I welcome it. For example, first class seating on flights. I personally, I've done it. When I was practicing as an attorney, that's pretty much exclusively how I used to fly, business or first class. And, you know, I mean, I didn't pay for it. I've flown first class on Emirates, which is arguably probably the most beautiful
Girl.
First class experience that you can, you know, experience. Again, I did not pay for that. That like one way is like $8,000. I was flying into Athens. So why am I pointing that out specifically? I don't really find value in that. Why? Because I cannot physically sleep in public places.
Mm.
Right?
Wow.
So if I'm going to, I know it sucks, right?
That does suck.
So if I'm going to spend on a flight, I'm not going to gain the value that someone else that could enjoy, truly enjoy that additional space and, you know, that reclining seat or the full-blown bed, right? I'm not going to enjoy it like someone else will, and I'm not going to value it in that way. And so that's just something I'm probably not going to spend money on, right? But what I will make sure I spend money on is a direct flight.
Yeah, you know? That's true. That's true. I actually, funny you should say that. I like sort of disagree and agree in the sense that like, I assume when you're saying first, are you referring to business class or like true first?
Either business or first class.
You've been in true first class? Because that barely exists on a lot of airlines anymore.
Like Emirates. That's which crazy. It's a cabin.
Well,
that's what I've been on. So it's like, and when people find that out, then they're like, oh, okay. So I guess you really don't care about spending
money. Yeah, I was going to say, you can't sleep in that thing. It's like an apartment in there.
It's an actual like closed room with an actual full-blown bed. And I did not sleep not even 1 minute on
that's
that flight.
Crazy. Yeah. Well, let me say this. So I disagree in the sense that like, I definitely like, especially if it's a long haul flight, like to me, it's not even a question of the flight itself. It's like, if I'm flying business to Europe, it's almost always overnight from New York. Mm-hmm. I will get a full night's sleep. Mm-hmm. And that means I'm not really jet lagged. So I'm like, I enjoy the next few days. Like when we're going to LA back and forth for work and I'm only there for 72 hours and every day is work, it's like, oh yes, this does make a real difference. Yeah. And obviously if it's a corporate expense, that's one thing. However, I do think even for something that you're like, oh wow, this makes a difference to me. And like I personally prefer a more comfortable flight over like a much nicer hotel. For me, a hotel I really don't care about. I'm like, I want it to be well located, like central. I want it to be clean, but like I don't plan on spending a lot of time there. So it doesn't really matter to me. It's not like a big difference maker, whereas the flight is. However, I do think even within things that make a difference to you, it's very important to try and put a dollar value on how much of a difference it makes. Because like I have, I don't think literally ever once paid like the full price ticket listed price for a business class. And I often don't fly it. Like I'll fly it when I can, but it's only through points hacking. Like I choose like a perk with my like medallion thing that like I get to upgrade for free four times a year. Like there's like ways to get around it where you're only spending. And if the difference is a couple hundred dollars on a flight, maybe. Depending on the flight and the circumstances. But then once you get past a certain point, like unless it's a corporate that's paying for you, in which case spend all their money. Like, I will take that $15,000 flight or whatever.
I will go first class to Athens on Emirates.
Correct. I will be. If it's like, I don't know, if it's like Bank of America that's paying, how about you charter? Well, I'd never fly private environmentally. It's horrible. But all I'm saying is that like there needs to be, because I do think a lot of people, you know, flights are one example, but I do think a lot of people can get into that real lifestyle creep thing with like, this makes a big difference to me. So I'm no longer able to really justify where that price differential exists for my budget.
Yeah. You know? Can I talk about bags as one?
Well, you're a bag girly. Yes. I am not. You love a designer bag.
I do. So that's one thing that I do enjoy, genuinely enjoy spending money on. I do love a nice luxury handbag. But I have a cap. Exactly what you were just saying. My cap is $2,000.
That's a lot of money.
I know some people will be like, that's more than my rent. That's absurd. I know. But when you're talking about the luxury handbag world, where you can easily spot a bag for $3,000, $4,000, $5,000, where Chanel's recent price increase brought their like classic flap up to like $9,000 or $10,000, where Birkins are being sold and people are talking about them very casually, might I add, on social media, like it's no big deal, you know, a $25,000 purchase. When you think of it that way, I think that having a concrete number that you are not willing to spend more than is good for something like, if, for example, your interest is, like it is for me, luxury handbags. Also, another thing, and I talk about this in the book too. I talk about, you know, cost per wear. Something I'm very, very passionate about. I'm not going to just buy a handbag and have it sit in my closet collecting dust. I'm going to use it. So I need a handbag that's functional. It needs to be practical. It needs to actually hold things. Now, I'm not going to lie, those mini bags are like super cute, but they don't even fit my phone. So it's it's not going to happen, right? And another thing is that I don't need excess. Right. I don't need a collection of 20 handbags. Right. I really don't, you know? So all I need is a set amount. I think currently I own, I think it's 5 luxury handbags in different sizes, which suit my needs. And some of which were actually purchased pre-love. Like I have a Chanel handbag that I purchased pre-love for, I think it was like $1,900, right? Now, for a lot of people, these are, look, trust me, I get it. My husband is like, that's a lot of money, right? But it's something that, you know, I personally enjoy. And so someone that, you know, does not want to spend on luxury handbags, but maybe they're into watches or they are into that nice expensive hotel experience, right, or whatever it may be. Or
like Michelin starred restaurants.
Exactly. You know, so you kind of find what you value, what makes sense for you, and spend there. I'm very passionate about doing that. And in the book, I talk about value-based spending. I talk about minimalism. I talk about capsule wardrobes. I talk about, you know, cost per wear, cost per use, really guiding principles that I have kind of followed. And another thing is all the handbags, I actually did a post on my Instagram about this. All the handbags that I have purchased in the past few years, I generally follow like a one handbag a year kind of rule. All of them have actually appreciated in value. So if I wanted to sell them right now on the secondhand market, I can get not only what I paid for it, but I can also make a profit out of it. Now, am I trying to say that these are like wise investments? No, right. No,
but right? They're not totally depreciating.
No. But they're not depreciating in value. I think, you know, if you take care of them and you're, again, and it's something that you genuinely enjoy, then go for it. But be honest with yourself and don't just listen to what other people are saying you should or shouldn't buy.
How much was that Louis Vuitton bag you got sitting over there?
So that one was, I believe when I paid for it, it was like $1,400. And now it's appreciated by like $400 or $500 in value.
Did you buy a full price at $1,400?
I did.
Wow.
I did. I bought it in the Louis Vuitton store in Soho like 4 years ago, I think it was. And I mean, I think it looks in pretty good condition for a bag totally. That I purchased 4 years ago. And I looked it up on the secondhand market and it's selling for $400 to $500 more than what I paid for. Yeah.
That's interesting. You know what's funny though about luxury? So handbags are really the exception to this rule because they are, like you said, items that will often appreciate. Right. And, you know, they're very iconic. They're very beloved. There's like always a market for them. But for a lot of, and even among some of these brands, we're talking about like a Louis Vuitton, a Chanel, et cetera, like a lot of the less iconic, less sought after items, like there are not, I mean, not to that extent, but there are retailers that I really like for clothing where you go into any consignment store on like the Upper East Side or like a, honestly, Rich Old Lady neighborhood, you will find so many of these items in these stores. And one of the things that I feel like we really tend to forget in the fast fashion era is that a lot of the clothes from, you know, even just recent previous generations, like people were having these items for decades, you know, and you can still find like, you can find a great raincoat, like you can find a great sweater, you can find all these things that are, you know, like I've gotten a jacket or not a jacket, a knitwear piece that was originally like $600. I got it for $80, you know, and like these are pieces.
Quality fabrics. Yeah.
And I do think outside of the, again, outside of the really iconic handbags, like if it is something that's really important to you to have these really high quality, you know, stylish pieces, like there are a lot of really good ways to access these things. And especially from a sustainability perspective, you can't do better than secondhand.
Yeah. So that's what I did with my Chanel bag. I knew that I was not going to be like one of the girlies that goes into the Chanel store to buy a bag at full price for like $5,000 or $6,000. That is not in my budget, right? I have a cap. And so for me, I did know that I wanted a nice classic style Chanel bag in black. And that's what I went for. And I, you know, kind of dug around on the internet. And then I finally found one that was listed for, I think it was, probably $1,900. And that was one of my like debt-free gifts to myself is, you know, I was like, okay, I will purchase this handbag. And come to find out, I mean, it was actually made, I think it was something like 15 years ago. And if you look at the bag and you look at the hardware and you look at the leather, I mean, the construction is also just really, really nicely done. And look, I'm not trying to say that everyone should go out and purchase luxury handbags and clothes and shoes or anything like that. But I think that if it is something that interests you, I highly recommend going with, first of all, a sinking fund, right? So that's a savings fund for either a short term or irregular expense. So if it's something like, well, I want to save for a luxury handbag, you know, it's going to cost me $2,400 as an example. I'm going to save $200 every month towards that goal. And then once you have that money saved, you can go for it and purchase the bag. But the second thing is to first look in the secondhand market and see if the item that you want is there, because actually a lot of times you will find really nice quality pieces at maybe even under the budget that you were intentionally, that you were initially planning on spending.
I'm so excited to be teaming up with Nuuly once again for this episode of the Financial Confessions. The holiday season is unofficially here, and you know I love an excuse to dress up. I'm looking forward to things like the TFD Holiday Party, our upcoming live podcast event here in NYC, and plenty of themed dinners happening over the next 2 months. Having my monthly clothing rental subscription with Nuuly will make all of my outfit preps so much easier. And we've teamed up with Nuuly. Just go to Nuuly.com, that's Nuuly with two U's, and enter the code TFD20 at signup to get $20 off your first month. With your Nuuly subscription, you get your choice of any 6 styles you want to rent each month. You choose whatever you want, and they have styles for everything you may have going on. Get access to thousands of styles from more than 300 brands, everything from party dresses to premium denim and one-of-a-kind vintage pieces. They're size inclusive, with everything from petite to plus size and up to 5X and maternity. Plus, you enjoy fast free shipping and returns and professional cleaning in Nuuly's state-of-the-art laundering facility. And you always have the option to buy what you love, which I've done myself with my own money from Nuuly, sometimes up to 70% off. Nuuly is the perfect place to get all of your holiday outfits out of the way in one go. With 6 items to choose from and the option to add 2 bonus items, you can get Friendsgiving, Thanksgiving, Hanukkah, holiday parties, Christmas, New Year's, and any other event you've got going on covered with just one bag. Plus, and it's new this holiday season, you can gift 1, 2, or 3 months of Nuuly through the gifting platform Goody. Renting through Nuuly means you get to try out way more clothing for a lot less, and it helps curb that must-buy-something-new feeling you get when there are big events on the calendar while still giving you new things to wear. Like I said, I've been using it for a few months now, and I have actually broken out my own wallet and spent my own money on some Nuuly items because I just love the process so much, and I plan to keep doing it on my own dollar once this campaign is over. Nuuly is already a great value at $88 a month for any 6 styles, but right now you can get $20 off your first month of Nuuly when you sign up with the code TFD20. That's Nuuly.com, Nuuly with 2 U's, and use code TFD20. Nuuly subscription clothing rental. Change your clothes. We traditionally associate the need for hair growth products with men, so we're excited to be partnering with Nutrafol to address hair growth issues amongst women. To be totally honest, hair growth is not something that personally affects me, so my friend and TFD's marketing director, Rachel, asked to try out these products for us. 30 million women are impacted by weakened or thinning hair, and if you're among them, know you're not alone and that there is a solution you can trust to deliver results. Rachel shared that this is something that she's really struggled with since giving birth. After all of her other postpartum symptoms subsided, it's the one that has remained the longest. She's changed up the products she's used and stopped applying heat like hair dryers and curling irons completely, but nothing has made a real impact. She started taking 4 Nutrafol capsules every morning with breakfast and says that she can already see a difference in the amount of hair she's shedding. And we love that for her. Nutrafol is the number one dermatologist-recommended hair growth supplement clinically shown to improve your hair growth, thickness, and visible scalp coverage. In a clinical study, 86% of women reported improved hair growth after 6 months. Nutrafol supports healthy hair growth from within by targeting the 5 root causes of thinning: stress, hormones, environment, nutrition, and metabolism, through whole body health. You can grow thicker, healthier hair and support our show by going to Nutrafol.com and entering the promo code TFC to save $15 off your first month subscription. This is their best offer anywhere, and it's only available to U.S. customers for a limited time, plus free shipping on every order. Get $15 off at Nutrafol.com, spelled Nutrafol.com, promo code TFC. Big news! We're filming a live episode of The Financial Confessions, and you're invited. Join me and Aaron Lowry of Broke Millennial at City Winery in New York City on December 14th, and come dressed in your holiday best. Join us for our VIP cocktail and networking hour at 6 p.m., or just skip ahead to the big show at 7:30. Along with the live podcast recording, we'll also have interactive trivia, games, and giveaways with a special appearance by Cindy Zuniga-Sanchez of Zero Based Budget and other friends of TFD. It'll be a fun, festive, holiday-themed night out, and we want you to be there. Space is extremely limited, so grab your tickets at the link in our description.
You guys recently moved to a different area and apartment. Mm-hmm. that is more expensive than where you were living before. Can you talk a little bit about, you know, kind of the thinking there, but also like specifically how you're avoiding kind of getting on the lifestyle inflation hamster wheel as the costs of living increase?
Yeah. So my husband and I, we were living first, I lived in Harlem for about 7 years, and then we moved to the Bronx and we lived in the Bronx for 2 years. We're originally from the Bronx, born and raised. And it was great. We had a really nice apartment. It was all good. But the thing is that I think especially being from New York City, we both wanted a change.
Sure.
We just wanted something different. We'd never lived anywhere else really, you know, in our lives. And we were like, okay, we want to do something a little different, but we don't want to do something so drastic, like move to the West Coast or move down South or anything like that, because we still want to be close to family. And so we found, we were looking at apartments in Jersey City, in the Jersey City and Hoboken area. And we landed on one in Jersey City because we saw that, you know, it's very accessible in terms of, you know, public transportation, but also into New York City. So I would still be able to see family and whatnot, but it was obviously, it's more expensive than our apartment in the Bronx. And so for us, you know, it was a discussion that we had on, like, our rent cost is going to increase. Also, to be fair, when we moved, I mean, everywhere it was expensive. Like, we even looked at, you know, would we want to go back to Harlem, maybe another area of Harlem. And the Harlem prices were comparable to the Jersey City prices, which, you know, I'm like, if what we want to do is experience something a little different, you know, and we've lived in Harlem before, then might as well go with, you know, Jersey City. And so when we had that discussion, I was probably the one that was a little more concerned, you know, about this dramatic jump. Well, in my eyes, pretty big jump in rent. But also, we have to pay for water. I know, I don't like that. Here in New York City, if you rent, you don't have to pay for water. So that was like another expense we were going to have. And so we really spoke about, okay, how are we going to accommodate this additional expense? And so for my husband, you know, he got a new job, which came with a salary increase. So that helped with that, you know, with part of it. But also for me, it was like on my end, I was also going to be on my part paying a little bit more in rent. So with that, to answer your question, we had to really talk about and be honest with, what else are we going to inflate?
Right.
You know, like, what other expenses are realistically going to increase? And what can we keep the same? So something that we decided, and people thought, a lot of people, they still think that we're a little crazy about, is that we don't have a car. We still don't have a car.
Well, you live in New York City. No one has a car.
And so people are like, oh my goodness, but like, you're going to be living in New Jersey. You absolutely need a car. And I'm like,
Jersey City is basically like Brooklyn. It's like similarly accessible and it's very, you can walk everywhere.
I'm
sorry.
Like, I can walk to restaurants. I can walk to Target. I can walk to the train. I can walk to a bus if I need to. There are still Ubers across the river if I need it. So I don't need to necessarily do that. And that is a big deal.
Right.
You know, it is a big deal. Just that, just us not deciding like not to have a car. You know, sure. Would a car be convenient? Absolutely. Especially because our building provides a parking spot, right? Which is like a luxury.
It is a different world over there.
It is a different world, you know? And so that could be a plus there, but we don't really need it. So
sure.
Could it be convenient to just hop in the car and, you know, go to Target on a Saturday? Absolutely. But we could also just walk a little, and which is like,
totally,
for our purposes, what we enjoy doing anyway, you know? And so that's really what it came down to. It came down to an honest conversation of, how are we going to handle the rent increase, you know, together as a couple? How will we handle that? But also, like, what are things that we are going to just make sure that we still keep, like, pretty low cost, that we're not going to necessarily inflate? You know, we don't order takeout a bunch either. Again, it's going back to the whole, like, we don't necessarily care about these, like, convenient foods, but we will go check out a new restaurant you know, in the neighborhood or something like that.
I feel like I'm going to do some sort of challenge because we've had our kitchen has been under construction for weeks. Like, I've literally been able to cook a functional meal in my kitchen one time in the past 3 weeks. And like, so I think that would be upsetting to anyone, but I really do love cooking. It's a big part of my life and it's a big hobby. And this has just been so horrible. And we have been ordering so much takeout. And when I tell you, like, I loved a takeout moment before. Who doesn't? It's great. Now I'm like, I never, ever want to see a delivery bag ever again. I'm like, the people at like Seamless must think I'm losing my mind. Like, I'm like seeing, like, people are recognizing my voice. Like, it is the worst feeling. So I'm like, I really want to do some kind of like a 30-day all cook and eat at home, like not even restaurants. I don't know. I might make one or two exceptions. But still, it's just like, even for someone who I think did enjoy those luxuries, it is really, I think, important to frequently challenge yourself to think about, like, well, what are the things, like, you guys, I assume, had a car before.
No.
Oh, you didn't. Would have gotten one.
Yeah, yeah.
But it's, like, good to challenge yourself, like, what are the things that I'm normalizing? What are the things that would be really nice to have that I'm sort of somewhat classifying as a need to have, even though it's clearly not? Like, I do think it's important to really reset those things, because otherwise it can start to feel, and I mean, it is the definition of lifestyle inflation, but especially in a time where there are so many conveniences and so many easy, painless ways to spend money, it's really important to look and be like, what of these things do I actually not need and I'm just sort of really used to?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of people, like, they told me, oh, but you need a car. And I'm like, I don't actually need a car.
You don't need a car.
So that's, you know, and I know I'm picking on cars here, but it is because it's a huge expense. I mean, if you think about, and look, I understand that not everyone lives in an area of the country where having a car is an option, right? There are parts of the country where you need to have a car. And quite frankly, I think that's because of poor public infrastructure in place and whatnot. There's so many levels to that whole conversation. But I think that, you know, if you think about car payment plus insurance, a garage, gas, repairs, tolls, all these things, I mean, you're looking at easily an additional $1,000 a month expense.
Oh, well, first of all, check out our episode with the War on Cars for a deep dive on this, because it is such a passion subject of mine. And ever since I've started following, like, bike and urban infrastructure people on social media, like, I'm just, like, filled with rage every day that we don't have better infrastructure in so much of the country. But, like, the idea that someone would be weirded out, like, for my reaction is, like, why would you have a car in Jersey City? Like, I know so many people who live or have lived there never had a car or rarely had a car. It's, like, not an obvious necessity to me. I understand how other people could look at it that way. But I do think, like, clearly if you live in Jersey City, you don't need a car.
Yeah.
Like, that's one of the benefits. Like, if you're going to be spending the money to live in a place like Jersey City, part of that benefit, like, part of the reason your rent is so expensive is because you have all that infrastructure. And, like, what is undeniable, even in areas of the country where there is less infrastructure than there is in somewhere like Jersey City, people have more cars than they need. Mm-hmm. They don't need to be taking a car for every single thing they're doing. Like, and I hate to harp on this, but especially since e-bikes are so common now, like, there are so many things in our day-to-day life that we don't need to be doing them the way that we're doing them. And I do think, like, it's very easy for us to get so accustomed to,
because it's ingrained.
Exactly.
That's why.
And also, like, it's so easy to forget that all of this ultimately comes down to selling people things that they don't necessarily need or more than what they need. Like, we've done videos on this, like, as the size of the American family has gone down, the size of the American home has gone
houses
up.
Houses, oh my goodness. I can go on for days.
Let's hear it, because I'm always ready to drag this subject. I can go on for days
on that topic. So my husband and I, we have, our apartment is, I think it's 950 square feet.
Which I believe is humongous, but continue.
It is, it's the biggest, it's like the biggest apartment that
we've
lived in.
It's a castle.
Yes. Okay, like when we have a laundry room.
Okay, I don't want to.
And now when I say laundry room, it's actually a closet that just fits a washer dryer
unit.
That's
a laundry room.
That is luxury to me.
I don't even have a washer dryer in my apartment. Go on.
And there's a door.
Totally.
So it's a laundry room. No one else will call it a laundry room. I call it that. There's space. There's a door. That's what it is. But no, all jokes aside, you know, when we first saw the apartment and I looked at, like, the living room, I looked at the floor, I was just like, this is huge. This is like so much space. And, you know, we have, we're using one of the bedrooms as my office. And, you know, it is really interesting because I think that in the Bronx, our apartment was about 650 square feet, also two bedrooms. Mm. It was very small. Compact. Our kitchen was like, it wasn't an actual kitchen. You know what I mean? It was kind of like the fridge and the stove and all that was like in the living room, kind of, right? But it was great and it worked out for us. And so now upgrading to, you know, like 200-300 additional square feet. Yeah, it is. It's massive. But I think what it is a lot of times, as you know, our lifestyles are allowed to have some type of inflation.
Sure.
Of course. You know, because we work hard and all of that, especially if you go from maybe like myself sharing a bedroom with two sisters your entire life, there is something nice to having your own space. But do you need 1,000 square feet just for yourself? I don't know. That's really for you to decide. It's, again, something that my husband and I, we don't necessarily value or care about. Like, people ask us, like, oh, do you want, like, when are you guys going to buy a house? That's, like, what people, again, kind of what we're talking about with cars, it's ingrained, right? People ask me and my husband, like, oh, so when are you guys going to buy a house? Well, first of all, we don't want to buy a house.
Right.
We're not interested in doing that yet. In the short term, though, more like midterm, I would say, we would probably be interested in buying a condo.
Right.
Because that's more fitting to our lifestyle. We don't need a McMansion to be happy. Also, quite frankly, the real reason why I don't want a house that big, drum roll, please, I don't want to clean it.
I don't want to have to furnish it. This is something I need to say here. So, yes, now we are two I'm child-free. I don't know where your stance is, but you don't have a child currently. I can understand people being like, well, yeah, it's just the two of you guys, like, and we have a small dog. But, like, you don't need the space. And I do understand, and I do want to acknowledge that. How effing ever. I cannot recall the last time I went to a large, like, a standalone home, let's say. Because it's not even necessarily super large ones, because I've been to super large ones. Like, I have even members of my own family who live in these houses where there's literally, like, entire, like, west wings that are, like, untouched. But even in the more moderately sized standalone homes that I've been to over the past couple of years, I have never been to one that didn't have at least one, often multiple rooms that are either unfurnished because they've just, like, never furnished it, or they're like, oh, we don't really go in there.
Yeah.
It's like a formal room that they don't use, like a dining room that, like, oh, this is our dining room, but we're always eating at the kitchen island or whatever, like all this stuff. And it's like, what I don't like is that, because I do agree, like, someone who, like, the people who lived in our apartment before us, they had a kid, which we live in a two bedroom that's, I think, 810 square feet or something like that. So they had one child in the apartment. They were like, this is working for however long. And then when they were having a second, they were like, we need that third bedroom. Mm-hmm. Totally understandable. I would probably do the same. However, I think there is such a delta now in American consumerism between what you realistically need and just what is kind of normalized as the next step. Yes. And I do think it should be more shocking to us than it is that it is basically the norm that in standalone homes, there are entire spaces within the home, entire rooms that are just unused, if not unfurnished.
Yeah, and you're paying for that.
And you're paying for it. And also environmentally, like, it's easy to forget, but, like, standalone homes, yards, like,
water usage,
the electricity, the two-car garage, like, all of these things have enormous environmental footprints.
Yeah, exactly. And that's why, I mean, there's a ton of research to show that people that live in cities and more dense areas have a less of a, you know, carbon footprint than those that live in, you know, suburban sprawl and whatnot. I'm not here to get into that debate, but I think you need to look at the fact of, like, what impact am I also having on the environment? I also do think that's an important conversation to have. Now, thankfully, my husband and I were very much on the same page. My husband is actually a lot more aggressive on this topic than I am. He is, like, very, you know, we don't need all these cars and you know, let's build up, let's upzone. Like he is all for that.
And urbanism, I totally king.
Yes, he loves urban planning, that whole thing. But I think that also we do need to think about how that actually impacts our finances.
Of course, yes.
It's huge, you know, because if we wanted to go with this big house, well, first of all, that's not really an option in New York City. Let me just put that out there, right? No. These big houses aren't really an option. And if they are, they're going to cost like $2 million easily.
At minimum.
Easily. And so for us, again, back to the whole value-based spending thing, right? If that's something that you truly love, that you have always dreamed of living in a big home and et cetera, you know, fine, you know, of course, do you. But for me, I don't care to live in a space where I'm going to be paying unnecessarily for all this square footage that I'm not using, that I'm having to clean, that I'm having to furnish. And it's just, to me, it doesn't make sense. And so, you know, for us, with our new place, I am very happy that we use it well, but we're also not looking to unnecessarily fill it up with stuff, you know, right. Because we do have a little bit of extra space, I think, especially like in the living room area. We're not like, oh, you know what, we should put another couch there, or right. Like our current couch is perfectly fine. You know, we brought our furniture all from the old place so that we didn't spend thousands of dollars on furnishing, you know, our new place just for the sake of furnishing a new apartment. But I think those are all things that people really do need to think about. And I think it goes to the larger issue of, what are you spending money on because it's what's expected of you?
Oh, 1,000%. Yeah. And it also, I think, expected of you is a really good word for it, but also remembering that with each thing that you add to your life, whether it's a square foot in a home, whether it's outdoor space, whether it's another car, whether it's more, you know, items in your wardrobe, you're also representing an expanded level of upkeep and of yeah. mental load. You yes. know, I think one of the things we've talked about a lot on previous episodes, like we've interviewed a lot of people who are kind of minimalist when it mm-hmm. comes to things like their wardrobes, yeah. You know, other personal belongings, in part because they find that the more things they have, and there is data to support this, like you get overwhelmed with choice. You feel like you no longer even know what you have. Mm-hmm. It's just the act of maintaining, of cleaning, like you yeah. said. All of these things represent expanding sort of financial burden, but also a huge mental burden. And I do think like there is a real easy tendency when we find something that we like, A, like we discussed, like you can justify spending exponentially on it, but you can also really justify accumulating, you know?
Yes.
And when the thing that you're accumulating is space in particular, I think that becomes a really dangerous cycle because you have to fill that space.
Yes. And I think that a lot of times people are bothered by empty space. It's like, mm-hmm. oh, I need to fill it up with stuff. I will speak on my perspective as a first generation Latina from a low income community. I have found that not just with my family, but with families in similar situations, you know, growing up, we didn't have a lot of discretionary income. And so anything that we did bring into the house, it stood in the house. There was no such thing as decluttering. There was definitely such thing, though, as accumulating.
Right.
And so for us, for example, little recuerdos, which are like little ornaments, right? The baby shower, the wedding, all of that would like fill up our living room, you know, and I knew and it bothered me. And I didn't really understand why all that stuff bothered me growing up. Another thing is that I shared a bedroom with my two older sisters who, you know, we're very we have big age gaps. So we were in very different parts of our lives. Like my oldest sister was, you know, 16 when my middle sister was 8 or 9 and I was 3.
Right.
Like we were, yeah. So a lot, again, a lot of stuff. And I think that for me, I didn't really understand why it was that I was so passionate all of a sudden about minimalism when I started reading about minimalism. And then I think I started unlocking the real reason why. And I think it's because, you know, when you grow up like I did, low income, where maybe your parents they were poor in their respective countries. And so they come here. And so anything that they are able to purchase, they're going to make sure that it stays in the home, that it does not just get donated or whatever it may be. But then that has a future impact then on the people who are occupying that space. And for me, it was this kind of like mental clutter that it would create. And so when I discovered minimalism, like many do, I started reading the Life-Changing Magic of Tidying Up, Marie mm-hmm. Kondo's book, which I do reference in my book as well. I decluttered easily 50% of my wardrobe because, unsurprisingly, in college and in law school, I was a little bit of a shopaholic. Mm-hmm. I loved buying clothes. I loved the fact that I was now able to spend money on these things that my parents couldn't necessarily afford for me when I was younger. And so now I'm going to not just buy it, I'm going to buy all of it. Right. I'm going to buy anything that I want, and I'm going to fill my closet up with all this stuff. But then what I found was I never had anything to wear. I wasn't actually happy with what I bought. I felt very guilty after a, you know, weekend at the mall, and there were things with tags still on. And so after, you know, reading that book, I thought I need to change things like this. I'm not creating a space that I'm finding joy in. And so I did. I decluttered like 50% of my wardrobe, and I've kind of kept up that more intentional spending, value-based spending, the one in, one out rule, right? Like if I'm going to buy a sweater, that means I'm going to donate a sweater that maybe I don't really love anymore, or maybe I'll list it, you know, and I'll sell it. And so that's kind of, you know, what I've put into place. And it is also something that, you know, Chelsea, to be very honest with you, has curbed this like underlying, like, shopping tendency yeah. that I had, especially in my early 20s.
Mm. Yeah. Well, and on that note, I do recommend our mini series with Hannah Louise Poston, because it's all about this stuff and she really dives into it quite exceptionally. We'll link that in the description as well. So Cindy, it has been a pleasure, as I knew it would be. Please tell everyone where they can get your book, and of course it will all be linked.
Yes. So you can find it at zero-basedbudget.com/book. You can buy it on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, Target, Bookshop, which supports independent booksellers, which we love to see as well. I want to quickly plug a couple of independent booksellers, The Lit Bar, mm-hmm. Which is a Bronx-based bookstore. And then we have, I think it's Café con Libros, I think that's the name of it. It's in Brooklyn. I'll send you the link so that you can include it as well. I'm very passionate about, you know, supporting independent bookstores as well. And you can find me on Instagram. I'm at @zero-basedbudget. You can also find me on TikTok. I'm trying TikTok. I'm not sure that I'm succeeding, but I'm on there. I am most active though on Instagram. And, you know, I'd appreciate your support. I think that, you know, the reason why I wrote this book is because I didn't see that representation on bookshelves. I didn't see really barely any personal finance books written by Latina authors. And for me, it was very important to share my story, share the knowledge, but also make for a more inclusive bookshelf, you know, and that's something that I'm really passionate about. That's why I'm so excited to finally have the book done, to have it out into the world. And, you know, I hope you all love it just as much as I do.
And as much as we do here at TFD, thank you so much again for being here, Cindy. And thank you all for joining. And I will see you next Monday on an all new episode of The Financial Confessions. Bye, guys. Bye.